religious aspect of the games. To begin with, some of the greatest scientists of the modern world, such as Kepler, Ampère, Darwin, Pasteur, Planck, and Einstein, have described that at the moment of discovery, they felt the same pleasure and excitement that a child feels while playing. Their admission regarding their experience offers a valuable insight to understand the meaning and the philosophy regarding play. Scientists feel that the impulse to play, which can also be called curiosity or exploration impulse, gives species and individuals an advantage in the process of natural selection. Biologists believe that few species retain in adult life their youthful capacity for play. I have been using the word play, and different scholars, scientists and researchers find it difficult to use games and sports as equally meaningful substitutes for the word play. This word differs in their concepts and meaning, and using them as synonyms leads to confusion. Renowned psychosociologist Bosquist has described play as, it's a desire for that with which one plays, not desire for something which one lacks and feels one must obtain. It's a desire for the here and now, for the passing and the coming moment. In other words, play is pure appetite for living, not for this or that type of life made desirable by fashion or habit, but for things as they are, for life as it is. He further states, the more play is authentic, as in the case of an absorbing children's game, the more the player feels free from the contingencies of all kinds. Playing totally unreasonable, and as the German philosopher Eugen Fink has remarked, it's an oasis of happiness in the desert of so-called serious life. Play is difficult to define. Play demands nothing. Play is innocence. Play is creativity. Play transmits no academic or social skills. It encourages an aesthetic appreciation of the world when the reason for playing is to win. The play ceases to be a pastime or leisure. Today's games and sports are the enemies of play. The encroachment of technology, advertising, and influence of money have made sports increasingly harsh and ruthlessly competitive. Leela and Krida are the two words which are close to the English word play. Only English language uses two words, game and play, but the same concept in French, German, Spanish, and many other languages is described by a single word. If we want to understand the philosophy, spirit, and cultural dimension of our Kridas, Leelas, Vinoda, and Utsavas, we will have to purge ourselves from the semantic influence of English language and colonial mindsets. The variety, diversity, its relation to religion can only be understood by Indianizing our outlook. Study of festivals, plays and games is as important as that of any other compartment of human activity. Encyclopedia of Britannica mentions that the history of sports and games is a part of the history of man as a social animal, his interrelations with other individuals and groups, his civilization and culture, and especially his play. British, German, French and other Western Indologists, when they came in contact with Indian civilization from 18th century onwards, were surprised to see a non-European civilization with a highly evolved language, philosophy, social institutions, art and architecture, and trade and health systems. Though they were aware of Greco-Roman tradition of sports, organization of games for competitive play, and codification of rules for each game took place in Europe only in the 19th century, Sir William Jones, the father of Indology, who initiated the study of language and comparative religion, had also observed, if the festivals of the old Greeks, Persians, Romans, Egyptians and Goths could be arranged with exactness in the same form with the Indian, there would be found a striking resemblance among them, and an attractive comparison of them all might throw light on the religion, and perhaps on the history of primitive world. As compared to the other aspects of culture, exclusive texts regarding sports and pastimes were not readily available to the scholars. The games of dice and hunting, as they were dominant royal games, did attract them, but other games and pastimes as enjoyed by the people at large went unnoticed. Unfortunately, the Indians, who by and large followed the Western studies of Indian culture and civilization, also neglected this dimension of culture. However, there are some scholars such as Padke, Om Prakash, Narendranath Jha Shastri, and few others have contributed research articles related to the subject. The Hindus seek release from the harsh vicissitudes of life through absorption into the great eternal spirit due to the causes such as debilitating climate, high mortality rate, pestilence and poverty. They were essentially interested in educating children to seek their place in the divine order and to preserve the caste system. The emphasis was on the future life rather than the present. The youngsters were not inspired to get on in the world or to help their fellow men or to identify themselves completely with national goals. The enervating climate sapped their strength and they accepted a religious philosophy that rejected bodily activity. This abnegation of life was in direct opposition to the maintenance of health and physical vigor. C.A. Butcher, in his book Foundations of Physical Education, repeated the same stories and observed that people of India are highly religious and they ignore the physical needs and desires of the body and concentrate solely on spiritual needs. He also states that Buddha prohibited games, amusements and exercises. However, this prohibition pertains to monastic life, while Jataka Kathas are full of sport and pastimes, including wrestling, boxing and dancing. R.B. Forst, in his book Physical Education, Foundations, Practices and Principles, refers to boxing, riding, hunting, dance, yoga, but gives very little information on physical education. E.A. Rice, in his book A Brief History of Physical Education, observed that due to the warm climate, people are indolent, dreamy and speculative. He further writes that Hinduism is inimical to progress, individuality, sanitation and physical education. He goes ahead and says that Indian history in style as far as athletic sports and physical education are concerned. All the above mentioned observations are not only incorrect and far from the truth, but they are mischievous. They have simply borrowed from the earlier writings of Indologists and Sanskritists, many of whom were missionaries, and have echoed the same theories in their writings on religion and social life of ancient Indians. Many Indian writers committed to alien ideology and intoxicated with reformist zeal borrow the same source material. Only a prosperous, stable and harmonious society can give birth to creative plays and pastimes. Social historians must take a note of these activities enjoyed by a society and reflected in its literature. We also have descriptions of common man's plays prevalent in different parts of the country, though called by different deferred names. We have a lot to learn from our past. We have to rediscover the true meaning of play, that's Leela and Kreeda, which give birth to creativity and pleasure. Play is something spontaneous, unorganized. Commercial and technological pressure is turning modern sports into a ruthless competitive industry. Violence and use of drugs seen in today's sports are inevitable outcomes of this approach. At this juncture, I would like to compare here and evaluate the religiosity absorbed in games invented in India with the Western invention of games which are violent. Yeah, this, I here take Mysore as an example, and the king of Mysore and his invention of Mysore games from Mysore as illustrations here. Yeah, this is perhaps you know the Karnataka state and the location of Mysore, very close to Bangalore. And this is the Mysore palace. It's not the exact palace. This is the Mysore palace. This is the original palace, main palace. And whereas this is the art gallery where we have, the king has put up lot many board games and the murals and the encyclopedic work of whatever he has invented. And this is the king, the Krishna Raja Vadiyar, who lived between 1794 and 1868 AD. And I would like to interrupt here saying that people have always enjoyed devising puzzles either for fun or as an intellectual challenge. And this king, King of Mysore, who was a great lover of horses, chess and board games, masterminded new games and preserved in the form of illustrated colored manuscripts, and also invented many ingenious combinations of the movements of cards on a chessboard. Indeed, it would be curious to see a collection of knight's tools in the form of murals in the art gallery. Mysore and the king is preeminent for such discoveries. Many of these paintings, that's multicolored chessboards, present pleasing pattern to the eye or show the figure of some animal, or geometrical pattern to the eye or show the figure of some animal, which are inscribed in the form of acrostics with numbers randomly written to cover all the cells. For any interested in chess and the traditional board games of India, the name of the king will always be held in respect and admiration. Poets, scholars, musicians and astrologers adorned his court, and he himself was a man of high cultural refinement with a pleasant and dignified appearance. But for the board game historian in particular, his name will ever rebound with honor. Krishna Raja Vadiyar, a skillful player himself at both card and board games, was also possessed of a wider interest in the games of his own country than mere play. This interest prompted him to collect information and preserve it as part of lengthy illustrated encyclopedias. In addition, he was responsible for the development of new games. Details of these were included in his accounts. The board game historian today is fortunately presented with a fascinating range of surviving materials that bear witness to this interest. Krishna Raja Vadiyar's encyclopedic compilation were written in Sanskrit. Three manuscripts which are attributed to him that are known to deal with chess and other board games are entitled Chaturanga Sara Sarvasva, Chaturangika Chamatkrita, Chamatkrita and Chaturanga Manjari. A very interesting point is that the king himself had masterminded several kinds of board games, which he had documented in a manuscript called Chaturanga Sara Sarvasva. He brought out a color litho print of an abridged version of his own Chaturanga Chamatkrita Chakra Manjari in six languages: Kannada, Telugu, Marathi, Tamil, Sanskrit and Persian in 1858 AD. This work details the construction of Akandagati Chakras by specifying the coordinates of the consecutive knight's moves on the Akandagati Chakra board so as to generate figures of various types. This corpus represents a significant portion of the distilled experience of Indian puzzles, tricks and games transmitted from generation to generation and preserved either through oral tradition or in written form as manuscripts. And he has also, this Jaganmohana Palace, which is also called as Sri Jai Chamarajendra Art Gallery, which was constructed in 1861. And this palace has number of paintings giving genealogy of the Mysore kings and other palace matters. The letterpress given in these as well as in some of the portrait deserves to be copied out and preserved or printed. Some of the games painted on the wall, such as Devi Sayujyam, and these are the games, Devi Sayujyam and Shiva Sayujyam, which are calculated to direct the thoughts of the players heavenwards, or full of interest. Many visitors to the place in Mysore skip the last room on the topmost floor, and if they visit, they will be amazed to see a large number of multicolored chessboards, that is 6 into 6, 8 into 8, and 10 into 10, and 12 into 12 square boards painted on the walls. Many of these paintings present pleasing patterns to the eye or show the figure of some animal. So I think these are some of the things which I am describing. These are the mural paintings. Yeah, and also those are the acrostics that have been, but it's really a night movements on a chessboard of a 12 into 12. But whereas we find an acrostics there. Many of these paintings present pleasing patterns to the eye or show the figure of some animal or geometrical shapes inscribed in them. A closer scrutiny reveals that these numbers appear to be written randomly to cover all the cells included in the figure, no number appearing in the cells not covered by the figures. The legends by the side of these chessboards indicate that the figures represent Akhanda Ashwagati Chakras. And this is also a game that has been put up in British Museum. This is called as Shiva Shakti Sayujya. This is a game. Yeah, it's okay. But this is also a copper plate. I think it's not visible, but it's visible in the sheet which I have put up there. That's the one. Yeah, this is a copper plate. I think nothing is visible, is it? Yeah, I think you can have a sheet. No, not this one. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this is a copper plate, actually. Yeah, this is a copper plate in the British Museum. And where the king has once again made an acrostics, and you can find on the left side the figure of Ramanujacharya, and on the right side the mark, the Sri Vaishnava mark, keeping on the forehead. See, Tirunamam. Yeah, Tirunamam. And in the bottom left side is Hanuman, and on the right side it's Garuda. For an onlooker who doesn't know anything about the game of chess or the board game, may feel that this is something connected with a religious piece. But it also speaks about a game. I was talking about the acrostics. He has moved a horse in a board of 12 into 12 and leave some space to get the figure of Ramanuja. Oh, that's really fantastic. Of course, the Krishnaraja Vadiyar was a very staunch Sri Vaishnava. Yeah. He himself speaks that Parama Bhagavatottama and Sri Vaishnava, he calls himself, and he renovated many of the Sri Vaishnava temples, right? Sri Rangapatnam, Melkote. Many. Yes, do you know?
How old is that connection with the Mysore temple? Is it as far back as the slightly close to Ramanuja connection, or is it?
Yeah, of course. Almost all the Odias, right from 16th century, they keep themselves as Vaishnavas rather than Shaivas. Of course, line with the Tathacharya's Guru Parampara, and his disciples continue to be the Asthana Gurus of Odias. So perhaps there might have been some link with the Sri Vaishnavism and the Odias of Mysore. And wherever we go, he invariably puts this Ramanuja and the Tirunamam. Whatever space is available. Oh, that shows that he was a very staunch Sri Vaishnava. And this is really interesting. One, on the one side, we find the religiosity, and on the other side, this is a purely a game board.
Is it based on Knight's Move?
Pardon?
Is it based on the Knight's Move?
Yeah, it's a Knight's Move. And very interestingly, he doesn't move the knight on all the board. He leaves some spaces to get a picture of what he requires, what he wants. That's really very interesting. Mm-hmm. Whereas the mathematician Euler, he moved the knight in an 8x8 board where he could not finally end up with the first place. Mm. But whereas this man is really very intelligent, he ends up with an open solution. Yeah, he's really very clever. Yeah, this is really interesting. This is another Shivalinga. For an onlooker, this appears to be a Shivalinga. A linga has been found in a 12x12 square board. But I have transliterated that the Kannada numerals into English, and also I have put up in the bottom a geometrical shape, how it looks like. And for a game, for a person who is interested in a puzzle, we can question, if we have a 12x12 board, which is divided into 144 squares, how can you move a horse or a knight in all these cells, leaving 36 cells vacant? How do you move? And where do you start the horse? And how do you get the open solution? Oh, that's the puzzle here. But whereas this king has solved this problem. And the question is, how to decide which cells are to be vacant? And the next question is, how can you get the shape of a Shivalingam? That's another point. And the third point, where do horse starts its tour and ends so that the re-entry problem is solved? This is another question. And the solution is, the numbers are placed in the squares according to Shiva Ashtotra Stotra. He has given the Stotra in the manuscript. And each word has been converted into number. Yeah, for example, if it's Surya, it's 1. If it's Nakshatra, it's 27. If it's Loka, Triloka, so it's converted into 3. So he converts the words into number. So the solution is, numbers are placed in the squares according to the Shiva Ashtotra Sotra given here, and each word in the line corresponds to the number. This is how the Raja has solved the puzzle. And don't you find that though it's a puzzle or a game, and more religious in character? Yeah, this is another very interesting Navagraha pattern. On the right hand upper side, that's the painting that is found even here. We have that painting also. Yeah, somewhere here. I think it's somewhere up there. Painting.
Oh.
Yeah. And the puzzle is how a single horse can be moved in a 12x12 board and depicts geometrical shapes associated with Navagrahas. That's 9 planets. And it can be achieved in a 9 equal houses arranged in accordance with the Navagraha pattern. See, you should follow a circumambulatory, the clockwise direction. This is the rules of the puzzle. And now the king, a great lover of astronomy and astrology, perhaps wanted to pay homage to Navagrahas by depicting them in his favorite horse games. In this puzzle, he has divided the 12x12 square board into 9 equal subdivisions. And the horse which starts from the central portion, that's the sun position, tours all the 9 houses and moves in each house describing the geometrical pattern associated with a particular planet and the respective houses are located exactly in accordance with the Navagraha arrangement. The horse originates and ultimately culminates in the central square after executing a circular pattern associated with the sun, the center of the planetary system. The single horse tour over the whole bowl is complete and also give rise to a closed solution to the re-entry problem. The greatness of the innovator, the Raja, lies in his choice of movements in each of the nine houses, leaving the necessary cells vacant, thereby automatically describing the geometrical shapes attached to the planet. Perhaps you must be knowing the geometrical shapes attached to the planet. Sun is attached to the circular circle and his number is 1. And moon, the topmost upper square, that's moon. Its square shape attached to moon and the number is 2. And the bottom one, right side, in the middle, its triangle, it's associated with Mars, Kuja, and the number is associated is 9. And the bottom right side, it's Rahu, the number is associated number is 4, and it is trapezium. And the next one in the middle, lower bottom one, is Saturn, the number associated is 8, and it is crescent shape. And the next is Ketu, a flag, and number is 7. And the middle left-hand side is Jupiter, that's Guru, and it's a rectangular shape, and the number associated is 3. And the top left one is Buddha, and number associated is 6, and it is oval shape. And in the center, top one is pentagon, is associated with Venus, and the number is 5. And he is really genius to get these shapes which are associated with the planets. I think I feel that the games that are invented by the Raja of Mysore on one side depicts more, speaks more of religiosity and also spirituality. On the other side, if you look into the game part or puzzle part, it's really amazing. Yeah, in comparison to the religiosity that we have observed from the Indian games, I would be just jumping into the Western game that was invented during 1974. That's the Dungeons and Dragons. Perhaps you must be knowing about this. It's a fantasy role-playing game published by Gary and Anson in January 1974. It was first published by Gax Company, Tactical Studies Rules, and subsequently spanned the RPG industry. This Dragons and Dungeons and Dragons is by far the most well-known and best-selling RPG game, with an estimated 20 million players and over $1 billion in book and equipment sales as of 2004. A role-playing game is a type of game where players assume the roles of fictional characters via role-playing. In fact, many non-athletic games involve some aspect of role-playing. However, role-playing games tend to focus on this aspect of behavior. Dave Arnson is the co-author with Gary of the original 1970s role-playing game Dungeons and Dragons and an important figure in the history of role-playing games. Arnson's Black Moor, published by Tactical Studies Rules, was one of the first published role-playing game campaign settings and has the distinction of being the longest continuously played fantasy role-playing campaign at 25 years and counting. A version of his world, the first fantasy campaign, was published in the late 1970s by Judges Guild. The game evolved from war games with soldiers in which onlookers were given characters to play during the battle. Gygax and Anson were playing in Arthurian Knights version, when someone decided they wanted to play Merlin. Later they decided to hide in a cave, and they decided that if Merlin existed, then a monster might be in the cave. For those unfamiliar with this game, it is the grandmother of most fantasy role-playing games. Now many understand that role-playing originated formally as a psychological tool. Most counselors and psychologists have used role-playing as a powerful way to transform human behavior and thought. For example, someone might have a problem with an addiction. The counselor might suggest that the addict role-play what might happen if a friend offers him a drug. This is done several times in several ways until the addict begins to develop refusal skills. The same could be done for people with anger problems or anxiety issues. The point to remember is that role-playing is a major and effective way to teach people new ways of thinking and acting. But the fantasy component is the second part of the question. In a way, this is the most problematic part. Obviously, changes in behavior can often be positive. However, the fantasy component in D&D and related games is mostly defined as inhabiting a quasi-medieval world full of magic and magical-related characters such as wizards, trolls, orcs, etc. It's a world very much like what is seen in the classic sword and sorcery genre of fantasy fiction. In this world, magic is seen as a part of everyday life, and the ethos of the game usually involves the acquisition of magical power by most characters. As in role-playing, the players take on characters or roles. The broad categories of these would include warrior, wizard, priest, rogue. In recent years, new permutations on these basic classes of characters have been added, including the barbarian, the sorcerer, the paladin, and the monk. Very interestingly, the last character does not appear to be any sort Catholic monk, but rather than a monk from more Eastern religions with high levels of martial arts and occult experiences. A reader will notice that already some genuine magical terms from real witchcraft and occultism have been introduced. Druids and bards are both part of the priesthood of ancient pre-Christian Britain. Wizards are, of course, the classic practitioners of magic, both in reality and in fantasy fiction. Once the player has chosen their character, warrior, rogue, etc., they then need to choose their alignment. In D&D, this is a technical term meaning the crossing of two scales. The first is the character's position on the continuum between good and evil, with the choices being available anywhere in between perfect good and appalling evil. The second is the character's place on the continuum between law and chaos. Here again, the character could range anywhere from being a perfect law-abiding citizen to being in favor of absolute anarchy. We are told in one of the game handbooks, the character's alignment is a guide to his basic moral and ethical attitudes towards others, society, good and evil, and the forces of the universe in general. That sounds straightforward enough. However, you need to realize that quite often players will pick an alignment that is more evil or chaotic because it's more intriguing. This is much the same as why many talented actors would rather play villains. There are actually 9 possible combinations of alignment ranging from lawful good to chaotic evil, with 7 other combinations in between. One other issue needs to be raised about alignment. The morality expressed in D&D is fuzzy. The best end is certainly not the morality which has been expressed in Bible. The same handbook tells us that goodness has no absolute values, although many things are commonly accepted as good. Different cultures impose their own interpretations on what is good and what is evil. For example, you can have a lawful evil character. A handbook states that a lawful evil villain methodically takes what he wants within the limits of his code of conduct without regard to whom it hurts. He cares about tradition, loyalty, and order, but not about freedom, dignity, or life. Talk about a mishmash of moral ambiguity. Our young people are having enough trouble getting their values straight without being immersed in this sort of material. Finally, to play the game, the person's character needs the tools of their trade. These include such mundane things as food, clothing, etc., with many dozens of items listed. Additionally, some 60 different kinds of weapons are listed, such as battle axes, crossbows, and swords. Additionally, however, characters may get to choose various magical tools, spells, charms, bands, talismans, potions, plus magical versions of most weapons. It's important to understand that each of the above magical artifacts exists in real world sorcery and witchcraft. They are just as real as swords, saddles, or crossbows. Thus, role-playing in this sort of game prepares the player for thinking like a magician. How seriously they take that preparation is something we need to consider. How is this magic seen in the game? Well, in a guide written by the original author of the game, Gary, magic users draw upon arcane powers in order to exercise their profession. He or she must memorize and prepare for the use of each spell, and its casting makes it necessary to reabsorb the incantation by consulting the proper book of spells. Those of magic users must be spoken or read aloud. This is excellent advice for budding necromancers. This is obviously a game which requires real initiative and dedication, but look at what games are filling their heads with. Other than the magic issue, as we have seen, the overall morality of the D&D universe is pragmatism at best and amoral at worst. Might makes right seems to be the rule. You are to take treasure or magic away from other players using whatever means are available, including force, magic, intimidation, coercion, and negotiation. An advanced D&D master's guide advises the best way to avoid taking damage is to bet the foe so badly he wants to crawl under a rock, or better yet, run away. Now, is it not that a wonderful law of the jungle kind of morality to instill in youth? Whatever happened to the beatitudes or gentleness and forgiveness or turning the other cheek? These things seem entirely absent from D&D. Of course, they are not very worldly or exciting. Additionally, the games are very violent. John Eric Holmes, a doctor and editor of the Dungeons & Dragons basic set, believes that the game can be a healthy outlet for antisocial behavior. However, he remarks that the level of violence in this make-believe world runs high. There is hardly a game in which the players do not indulge in murder, arson, torture, rape, or highway robbery. So I think it goes on like this. So much about the Dungeons and Dragons. I do not know whether you are interested in listening to the Western game. Perhaps you must be aware of it. No, I just want to make you understand. Yeah, these are all the different forms of. And this is the dice, the 20-sided dice. This is newly invented. This is something connected with the violent aspects of a Western game that was invented some 200 years later. So I was talking about the King of Mysore, who discovered a game which is sober, which is religiistic, which is spiritualistic, though it is a puzzle trick game. But whereas after 200 years we find that the civilization evolves, but whereas I understand it's not evolving and it's going in a different direction. That's what I just want to make you understand. Okay, thank you. Yeah, sure.
We have this game with Shivalinga.
Yeah.
And this Navagrahati. I don't really understand how the game works actually. I mean, I understand how the pattern sort of evolves, but how do you play the game?
See, it's. I think you should have a knowledge of chess, basically. And in chess, you should also know how the knight moves. Perhaps you must be known.
Yeah,
okay. Then I'll show you. See, that this is a board. I think you can just forget about the Shivalinga. You can go to the left side part.
Mm-hmm.
It's only a duplication.
Mm-hmm.
I have created the board there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a 12 into 12 square board, which has got 144 squares.
Mm-hmm.
The puzzle is, you need to draw a Shivalingam inside the board.
Mm-hmm.
And the Shivaling, that's called as acrostic. In one hand, you need to move the horse within the board, and on the other hand, you should get a figure of a lingam.
Mm.
Okay?
And
it's not actually a game. It's a puzzle. And he starts the game here. I think you can identify the right-hand side, the second column.
Yes.
Okay? He starts the horse movement in that particular square. Why? Why should he? As far as the horse movement is concerned, why not in the upper part? Why not in the right side? Why not in the left side? Why should he start in the... that's in the 11th column.
Mm-hmm.
11th row and the last column. 12th call. Why?
Is the player provided with the number?
No.
So
what he gives is this Shivashtatara Stotra in the manuscript. And he explains that you should move like this. And very interestingly, I told you, we should convert that word into
the number.
Mm. Number. Mm. And he says that in such and such a call, you should start the word number or the word in particular 11th column, 12th row.
So he gives a
guidance, but not always. It's only in one place he gives a guidance, but later we need to find it out.
Mm-hmm.
And he moves the horse, and you can find out 108 is not very far from one. Once again, from 108 you can enter one. Oh, that's a closed solution.
Mm.
Whereas many of the mathematicians, Western mathematicians, they could not find the closed solution.
Mm.
It was kept vague, open. They could not come to the entry point. That's really the problem, actually, as far as the chess game is concerned or the knight movements is concerned. You have, that's a re-entry problem. You need to come to the point one.
Mm.
See, when you come to 108, once again the horse comes to the point one. But whereas many of the scholars, they could not do it.
Mm.
He was genius enough in not using many of the cells,
mm-hmm,
and finding a solution to the re-entry problem, and also speaking about something about the religiosity.
Mm.
Did he do it mathematically or by trial and error?
No, I think that's in the manuscript. It's very clear.
Mm.
It's not. It doesn't appear to be like a trial and error. And in fact, he has devoted some hundreds of pages for this knight's movement.
Because there are many of these copper plates that we showed in the British Museum, I think, with different knight's tours.
Many of them. Many of them.
With different designs,
yeah.
Krishna,
yeah.
And
yeah.
All sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
So it must have, and he must have had a method to do so many.
But when I was talking to the computer scientists, they said it's a permutation combination.
I see.
And if you have an algorithm,
right?
Yeah, if you devise 8 into 8 board, 10 into 10, 12 into 12 boards,
yes,
and if you have got an algorithm,
yes,
you can devise.
Would you have had that in the state of my
soul? No, I don't think so. He had no algorithm. His algorithm was only the stotra, shloka. He had no algorithm, but now we can prepare this. If we have an algorithm, we can devise some thousands of pictures like this.
Yes.
Oh, this is really interesting.
But he composed the stotra, didn't he?
Yeah, he himself.
Yes.
For every picture, he gives a shloka, even for this.
Yes.
This is something, a swan, but he has moved the horse inside the swan, and he gives...
Same
principle.
Did he have pundits to help him, or did he do it all himself?
I don't think that he has done. In one of the manuscripts, one Rama Shastri from Andhra Pradesh, for the sake of living, traveled to the court of Raja and stayed with him, and because he was well versed in all the three languages, Sanskrit, Telugu and Kannada, he was appointed for writing the manuscript. So he calls himself as a scribe in one of the manuscripts which is in the British Library.
Yes. Because all the intellectual content was the Raja's own. He didn't have any mathematicians or astrologers.
He might have had, but we don't find any reference to that.
Yes.
He might have had.
I was going to ask you that question. How do we actually, do we have any historical evidence that actually the Raja came to this, or did he have his
but every page he calls, I think you can read Kannada. See, this is a game that he has invented. Devi's Ayodhya, Shiva's Ayodhya. In the top, he says that on such and such a day, on such and such a week of the year, I, Krishna Raja Vadiyar, has invented this game. He calls himself like that.
Right.
He is really fascinated.
Yes, yes.
Whatever space is available, he puts his name, Krishna Raja.
That's interesting.
Yeah, every page he devotes a column to call himself.
Yes.
This is really amazing. So how do we deny him?
Well,
we should give him the authorship. No, but not the Krishraj Odiyar the third.
Yeah.
No, it was in fourth. No, this is Krishraj Odiyar the third. So the country was, the Karnataka was calm, peaceful, there were no wars, nothing.
What was happening?
It was peaceful. And Tipu's and Hyder Ali, that was during the Krishraj Odiyar the fourth, actually. There was a lot of chaos and problems. But this man was really calm without any problems. So perhaps because of the leisure time and for fascination, passion, he might have invented. He was really very much fascinated by the chess, horse movements and horse racing. Always he is after horse.
Did he have a large stable of horses?
Yeah, very much.
Yes.
Very much. Everywhere, even that's a mural painting actually,
yes,
the second floor of the art gallery.
Mm-hmm.
And it's on the wall actually.
Mm.
Wherever possible, he puts a horse there.
Mm.
And even in the manuscripts, he could have moved a queen or a king. Queen's movements is as important as horse in a chessboard. But he has not tried to do the queen.
In this game, it looks like you don't need a whole lot of pawns because, I mean, you just need the horse. Because that's the only one moving. Right?
No, even queen can be moved in a board.
What I'm saying is just one. Whether you choose queen or whatever.
Very interestingly, in other boards, he has moved simultaneously four horses.
Mm. Yeah, but it's the horse.
Four horses. In another board, not only that. No, I think it should be, you should not misunderstand. He has moved camel, elephant, horse together, following the rules of the chess.
But is it always the horse move? Like
one, two. No. Camel moves in a diagonally.
Oh, sorry, camel.
And elephant moves straight, and the horse leaps.
Okay.
Oh, he follows the rules of a chess.
He has done
that too. But most of the figures are knight tools rather than any other.
So it's not a single piece consecutively moving from number one to...
It's a single piece.
Mm-hmm.
As far as this is concerned, this is a single piece.
Mm-hmm.
But there are number other pieces too.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, he is more concerned with symmetry, symmetrical proportion, mathematical, logic, algebra, trigonometry is very much concerned with all this language, philosophy, and gives more importance to all these aspects. And also when he writes a poem, he says what meter he is using for that particular stanza.
But this diagram here is asymmetrical. I can't understand how you kind of work it out.
No, I'm talking about in general. Mm. No, but this is an acrostic. His main intention was to get the figure of lingam.
Yes, I know.
Yeah.
It's just that the diagram is mathematically, it's not symmetrical, but there is no trivial.
No,
the picture isn't
this is okay. This is okay. But it's there are many other figures where, oh, there are hundreds of figures. I have given you only two or three. Mm. That doesn't give you a full picture.
Yeah, I think the question that you raised earlier, why you should begin at the bottom instead of the top or something. What do you think it is? Could it be arbitrary or is there a ritual sequence?
No. Because the re-entry problem, that's a mathematical problem. See, unless if it's an open solution, there is in mathematics, as far as the chessboard is concerned, there are two problems. One is the open solution and another is the closed solution. Okay, this is the one that Euler, a mathematician who lived between 1701 to 1783, this is the knight's tour. Yeah, he could not solve the problem, re-entry problem.
So, when he plays this game, does he actually draw at the lines like this rather than?
No, he doesn't give. In fact, these two, I have done it.
But how does one remember if you're trying to at an entry point and then return to that exact point using only the force move, how do you trace each one of your moves to ensure that you are not covering the same square again twice? I mean, by drawing on it, at least you
If you don't have the numbers, it's really difficult.
Yeah, how can you remember it all? Because by drawing, at least you know, okay, this move takes me here.
Because there are numbers. You can join 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
But how do you remember it all?
No, but the numbers are given.
Oh, you write the numbers down.
Yeah, numbers are given. You write the numbers, you can join them, or you can even leave, like a horse.
But the technical game would be just remember them.
Remember them.
You actually construct the game in your mind. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of produce it. Mm. It's only the other pundit would see them. Mm. You know, the way you are moving, you're not actually showing them.
Okay.
But he can see what you're doing, and then eventually he'll tell you whether you got the linga or not.
Huh.
So he certifies the other pundit.
Mm.
It's kind of a challenge.
Mm.
So the pundit gives him a challenge, and then at the same time the pundit also has a challenge.
Mm.
Because he's not showing physically, okay,
right,
here is my number one,
exactly,
and so on. So he has to follow him, and eventually figure out whether this guy got the linga or not.
How does he do that?
It's like actually, you know, the challenge between the puddles.
Of course.
You construct a slope.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and you give a keyword,
mm-hmm,
and then ask him to construct a slope out of it, and then he actually has to figure out what the last this thing is, and he has to give another stroke,
yeah,
and then he challenges. So the challenge actually goes on like that.
Mm.
So nobody is actually writing anything. Mm. They just have to.
It's all remembrance. It's all remembrance. Even the pundits, they do this Ashtavadana and Shatavadana simultaneously. They don't write down anything.
Mm-hmm.
They remember everything. See, some 10 people, Shatavadana, 10 people will be sitting and they will be asking different types of questions. But the poet, the kavi, the pundit, will remember the questions, what they have asked, and combine all the questions together and find out an answer in the form of a poem.
So it's like a meditation on the leaves.
Yeah.
And the crucial thing is all...
That's Shatavadana.
Shatavadana, all 100 of them actually ask simultaneously.
But now not.
Not.
It was previously done. Simultaneously they used to ask, but now they one by one they ask.
There was one documented actually. It was on Indian television. Mm. It was Ashtavadana, eight pieces. Mm. Eight of them actually asked. Sometimes, you know, it would be sounding like a silly question. Mm. And they will all eight of them stand up and ask one time. And he has to remember and then go one after the other. Each one a sloka, and then he has to connect all the eight into one single theme and combine them and, you know, come up with a final answer.
Oh, it was a very big feat actually. Mm-hmm. It was really interesting. Even now, I think it goes on in some of
In Andhra, there are some poets who still do it, but
Professor Narasimhacharya, who is here as a visiting fellow, he went through this process.
Oh, I see.
You see, the old tradition depended heavily on memory. Mm-hmm. Of course, we now learn languages through kind of European, kind of method of, depending on the, the text. And they simply, I had a teacher who, recited to him shloka only once. And they would walk in the field, and the teacher would walk before him, and he would follow them as a young boy. Mm-hmm. And the teacher would repeat only once, and he has to repeat. And when he taught us, he would come to the class with nothing. Mm-hmm. He could simply recite the whole of Mahabharata. You wake him up in the scheme, he will tell you, from whatever sloka you begin, he will follow from there. Mm-hmm.
No, that was the practice. That was...
We don't have
that type of teaching now.
It's a technique, actually. It's a technique that they excel in.
I think it takes a while to get this flushing and just pouring yourself in.
Mm-hmm.